My name's Mike. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is December 19th, 1998, and my home group is the Monday Night Speakers Group. Meet over in St. Pete on Monday. 7:30, open meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, speaker meeting. No participation unless you want some free cake and coffee. You have to pay for the water. So it's always a big deal to be able to speak at the mic at an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. I personally felt that the speaker should have been the 45 minute and I should have been the 15. You know, she's got a hell of a program there. I don't know, that's a tough act to follow. You know, I guess I'm going to have to talk about the steps and God and try and make it seem like I know what the hell I'm doing up here, which is tough because I really don't have a clue why I'm still sober today. I like to think I know, but the reality is I don't have a clue. I don't believe that I'm that smart, that good. I worked that hell of a great program. I personally feel like, you know, I was just chosen, you know, stay sober. Because as hard as I tried to get drunk and screw my life up, I'm still here picking up chips. And, you know, only one here, I've came to the first meeting they had here and been coming back. And, you know, that and $1.25 gets you a medium big gulp, you know. Only one that I know is Bill. Bill was here when I got sober. He'll testify I was a really nice guy that really didn't deserve to be in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was court-ordered, and he'll testify to that. You can ask him afterwards. So I'm going to tell you what's described in a big book, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I was, well, like most people in Florida, I'm not from here. I was born in New Orleans, Louisiana, and that right there in itself makes me an alcoholic by default. You know, I came from a good, upstanding family. You know, never met my father. My mom remarried my stepdad when I was probably two or three. Older brother stayed with my mom's parents because she was living with them at the time. And my brother grew up with my grandparents. And I grew up with my mom and my stepdad. And that was my first resentment. I had this guy pitch hitting as my dad. Knew he wasn't my dad. Never called him dad. Always called him by his nickname, Bill. You know, I don't know why, you know, 3 years old, hey, Bill, no one ever corrected me. So that's kind of where the problem begins, you know, and it progressively gets worse. You know, as a young kid, you know, a lot of kids, you know, levitate to a lot of different things. And, you know, one important thing is I know it's Alcoholics Anonymous, and I know its primary purpose, and, you know, but for me, long before there was alcohol, there was the other white substance, and you know, I still struggle with today, and that is sugar. And you know, as a young child, I heavily indulged in sugar products of any flavor. It did not matter. You know, I used to wake up with some sugar smacks and follow it up by you know, drinking Coca-Cola. And then I remember climbing on the counters, taking shots of Hershey's chocolate syrup and corn syrup, and you know, you know, just kind of going hard after that, you know, and my mom would always, you know, when you're young like that, you're supposed to take nap time and all that stuff, but I was so jacked up on sugar, I probably couldn't sleep for a week, and, you know, she'd chase me around the house and corral me into my room, and I remember what I would do is I had a little 45 record player, and I would play my Santa Claus records, and my favorite one was Here Comes Santa Claus, and it'd be July, you know, and what it was is I couldn't wait for Santa to come back, you know. I love getting gifts. I don't know about you guys. It hurts to give, but, man, it feels so good to get, you know, and as a young child, I was always looking for Christmas, you know. I mean, you know, and I remember when Christmas would come, my great-great-grandmother would send all these gifts, and it'd be a huge box, you know. Well, when you're little, everything's huge, but it was a lot of gifts, and I figured out my mom never inventoried them, so I'd steal one a day. It's kind of like Hanukkah, you know. I'd grab one a day and go hide in the bushes and, you know, and open my gifts up. You know, I intuitively learned how to steal, you know, lie, steal, cheat. You know, young stuff and alcohol, it needs to craft and really get good at, you know, if you're going to be good at this thing. So early on, that's what I'm doing. You know, school wasn't my thing. You know, I figured out early on I don't like this. You know, did horrible in it. Horrible in school. I remember the best I ever got was in the sixth grade. I got best dressed. And so you can already see that I'm trying to make the inside, you know, make the outside appear to look like the inside is good, you know. So I'm really into presenting a certain way, and I'm in the sixth grade, you know, because I'm getting in trouble all the time. I mean, my parents were, you know, well-to-do. They were socialites. My wife says we were rich. I like to think we were lower middle class, but whatever. You know, so my mom was a big-time real estate agent. My stepfather, you know, had a construction company. And so I never went without, you know. And they would put me in the best private schools, tutors. I mean, anything money could throw at it, they sent me to shrinks to, you know. And now, granted, guys, I haven't taken a drink of alcohol yet. This is just off the sugar. So, you know, by the time I'm 13, I realized that, you know, I need a little something more than the sugar. You know, I need something a little stronger. And my parents were, like I said, socialites, so they did a lot of things. You know, we were always going here, going there. Like Archie Manning, you know, the Mannings, we would go to their house. My mom sold them their house. We'd go over there for Christmas. So the Preservation Hall band played at this party we had. And, you know, so we were always going to bars, restaurants, because their friends owned all this stuff. So I spent a lot of time not with other kids. You know, I didn't play well with others. You know, I'm very, very selfish. I was 13 at this big Christmas party, and I'll never forget. It was the first drink I ever had. You know, I can't tell you what I did earlier today, but I can tell you about that day. Me and another kid, we decided that we wanted to have a couple of drinks. And, you know, I had been warming up to the thought for a long time, like a lot of us do. And I love Coca-Cola, and I knew rum and Coke was a big drink because I had been doing Roy Rogers. I never did Shirley Temples. And I did Virgin Pina Coladas. I knew there was rum in that, and Strawberry Daiquiris had rum in it. So I said, hey, let's get a couple rum and Cokes. So we got these rum and Cokes. We drank them. And, you know, I remember that we didn't get drunk, but what I do remember is what's described in the big book Alcoholics Anonymous, the sense of ease and comfort that comes from a couple of drinks. You know, all them inferiority complexes, all them feeling less than, all them feeling not a part of, not feeling cool, you know, because cool is very important, by the way. You know, cool about killed me. You know, and what I do know is, again, all this stuff made sense once I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, is the progression. You know, I was 13, had a couple of drinks, and by the time I was 15, I was living on the streets. You know, if that ain't progression, I don't know what is. You know, my mom had my little sister, and my parents at that time had gotten separated, so my mom had my little sister, and she had me, and, you know, my friends in town, and we were talking, my wife and my buddy went out, and he was talking about a story, the 1984 World's Fair, and I didn't remember it, but he, you know, almost got arrested, so he really remembers it, and we had stolen some mopeds and got really wasted, and got pulled over. We broke into World's Fair because obviously we wouldn't pay, and we were really drunk, and then we almost got arrested, and I was like, when was this? And he's like, 84, the 84 World's Fair. I was like, wow, I was 14, you know? I'm like, thinking a 14-year-old, I mean, we were drunk as hell riding these mopeds. And, you know, of course, smoking weed. I mean, that's like smoking cigarettes, you know, whatever. Another big thing, I got molested as a kid, you know, and I suppressed that for a long time, and that definitely skews your world a little bit, you know. You know, by the time I'm 15, I'm living on the streets. I got into punk rock music, which is really cool because you don't have to have a lot of clothes. You don't have to have a lot of money. And you get to get real violent, which I found out violence works a lot. It motivates people to do things for you. And, you know, I'm a big manipulator. You know, from a young child, I learned how to manipulate. And as you get older, you know, you really want to manipulate people, and that tends to work. You know, and growing up in New Orleans is it's a rough place, you know, and then living on the streets and doing whatever the streets do, you know. I mean, I did everything, lie, steal, cheat, rob, hustled myself for money, for sex, broke into people's houses, robbed people, you know, got shot at. I mean, all the fun stuff a young man needs to learn how to do when you're 16 years old. And this is, and you know, the deal was, I used to think like I was a victim. You know, I had places to go. You know, my brother, they would take me anytime I wanted to go to my grandparents and live with them. They lived in the suburbs. They wanted absolutely nothing to do with the French Quarter. My mom would take me in. My stepfather would have took me in. But I chose the lifestyle I lived. And why did I choose it? Because I could drink and do the things I wanted to do. The only thing I had to worry about was the cops. And the cops in New Orleans are, they're a lot to worry about. But they really don't give a crap what you do as long as it doesn't really affect them. So, you know, it was real easy to stay under the radar there, and you could just run wild, basically. And then also, you know, you can drink 24/7. We don't have liquor stores. We don't, bartenders don't card. It's like money. Okay, good. What do you want? And I did that for a couple of years, and what ended up happening is I turned 17, and New Orleans, at that time, 17, you're considered an adult. And the problem was, I was an adult, and I went to the real jail, and my brother bonded me out, and I promptly went right back to jail again. And they didn't bond me out this time, so I did some time in jail, like 20 days, and they were telling me about Angola, and they were telling me about all these wonderful things they have for you in prison. And I was like, wow, that doesn't sound like anything I'm into. So I got out of jail after I did my 20 days and promptly skipped town. I wasn't sticking around to go to court or anything. Because prior to getting in trouble, my mom had a real good friend who was a juvenile judge. So anytime I get arrested, just kind of disappear or whatever. But this stuff was, felony adult stuff, and it's a little bit different. So I ended up going to Mississippi with my mom and totally forgot about going to court. You got a arraignment, and you're supposed to show up, and people put money up for your bond. And so I call my brother and tell him, that I'm moving to Florida, which is, what a lot of us do, when we're on the run. It's a sunny place for shady people. And, my grandparents said, that's probably the best thing you can do is just don't ever come back, because it was a big deal. The cops came to my grandparents' house. They came to my brother's work, and that was a big deal. I didn't think it was that big a deal, but apparently they did. And so I come to Florida. Everything's going to be different, but obviously it's not. I've moved here, and actually got my GED at Plant High School. I got a job at the Colonnade, thought it was all going to be different. It was all going to be different, but it wasn't. By the time I was 19, I was on my way to prison. Ended up going to prison once, twice. Got out when I was 24. My one friend, Dave, who's here tonight, we've been friends since, I was 18 or whatever. And he was my one friend. We've been through the whole deal. He'd accept my calls. His grandmother, I'd call him, "Hey, I'm in prison again, man," and we stayed friends through the whole thing. Actually, he helped me to get sober in the end. He ended up getting clean and sober before me and then helped me to come here. But anyway, getting ahead of myself. So what ended up happening is, and when you're incarcerated, they always kind of, send you towards these alcohol and drug things. Not as much as they do now, because this was in like the early 90s. They didn't have the court, the drug court and all this stuff. And of course, I never ponied up to having any kind of alcohol or drug problem. The last thing I'd ever admit is to having an alcohol or drug problem. I'm a criminal, yes. I'll take that any day of the week. But to be an alcoholic, freaking forget it, the last time I went in, I got involved in this riot and I got in a bunch of trouble. They transferred me to another prison. And the guy, when I got out, was like, people love to give you lots of information in prison, by the way. So it's a wealth of information if you ever need to go, And the guy told me, "Hey, man, if you go to AA and get involved in the drug programs, you'll get out sooner," which was a lie. I never got out sooner. That date never changed. 2.5 years to the day is when I got out. But prior to that, before I got out, I remember I coming out of a confinement, and the classification officer says, "Mr. Heath, you're nothing more than a career criminal." I was 22 years old, and he said, "All you're ever going to do is spend the rest of your life in prison, and we're going to put you out on the yard against our better judgment, and it's up to you how you want to do your time. We'll keep shipping you around." Now, prior to that, I thought it was real cool, sending the pictures home, being incarcerated and all that stuff, and getting out, but when that guy told me it really wasn't that cool, I'm like, damn, the rest of my life, like forever in here, like I'll do this little bit here and hopefully get out sooner because I'm going to go to AA. And, but it really sunk in. He was like, man, I want to get the hell out of here. I don't want to do this for the rest of my life. So I got out, and that's when I started going to AA and everything. And I used to go to the Friday night AA meetings. It was in Daytona Beach. And these two old guys would come in. And they'd have two meetings, a 12 and 12, and I think the other one was a big book. And I'd always go to the 12 and 12. We'd read out of the 12 and 12. And, I really thought AA was a great program. But like the speaker earlier said, I was definitely comparing. And the old guy, I'm not old. They had one speaker that I remember, young guy, probably looked about like I do tonight, shared about, you know, his drinking because, you know, to get into the jails and prisons, you generally got to have a good record. So he had a good record. So I said, well, there you go. AA's full of squares and old folks, you know, and I don't fit none of that criteria. So I got out and didn't go to AA. You know, I got out and worked my own program. I remember Nancy Reagan had a program called Just Say No, Abstinence, and I figured that was the one I was going to do. And when you're in there, you got a lot of time to read. So I read good books like How to Win Friends and Influence People, which is a great read, by the way, if you're a manipulator. I don't know that that was the intended purpose of that book, but that's why I read it. And so I got about, you know, the business of working and stuff. You know, I'd never really worked much. I worked for Spot and Steal, and we spot it in the daytime, steal it at night, you know, and dealing drugs. I mean, any kind of two-bit hustle you could think of, that's what I was into, you know. But in my mind, I'm a baller, but we didn't call it balling back then. You're just a piece of shit, you know, and you know, that's what I did. You know, I preyed on people's trust. That's what I did. I preyed on your trust. If you brought me in your house and you trusted me in there, you would never do that again. You know, so I'm working and not drinking, you know, figuring that's a good program. I was working. I had three jobs. You know, I got my license back. I had my license for about a year, lost it for seven. That tells you how I drive. So I got my license back. And then I got a job bartending, and it was at a country club. And I remember they drank the way that I should drink. You know, like, I need to drink like they do. So I started drinking Kettle One and imported beer, and, you know, that didn't last very long. Because before that, I drank, like, Private Stock, Ole, you know, Mickey's, you know, anything that was like a dollar. And so I'm drinking all this fancy stuff, but the outcome's pretty much the same. What ended up happening, I ended up getting a couple car accidents. You know, I started drinking immediately, got all these problems, you know. I ended up hitting a tree with my car. Luckily for me, the passenger didn't get hurt. I almost lost my eye. I had to have plastic surgery. I ended up getting in a fight with the sheriffs and the cops because they wanted to take my blood. I didn't feel it was necessary. And, you know, I learned, you know, three very important things you need to know when I was incarcerated. One is if you get hurt, you go promptly to the hospital and let your buddies take care of you. Two, if you get in trouble, you get a paid attorney, preferably one that's very expensive. And three, if you want to quit drinking, you go to Alcoholics Anonymous. So I kind of did it right in a row. You know, I got in trouble, got this real good attorney, and of course they tell me I need to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't really think I have a drinking problem. I think I got a get caught problem. You know, if I could just stay home, or if I could just stay where I'm at and not drive anywhere, that would be the problem. That's the problem. I drive. You know, I drive a lot. You know, I'm not the kind of guy that stays anywhere too long. And so, you know, I'm still driving. I end up getting in more trouble because I'm driving, but I'm not drinking. I remember telling the last time I got arrested, I said, hey, man, but I'm not drinking. The cop knows my name because he knows me because he's a DUI task force cop, and he knows me, who I am, my car, and that's why he pulled me over. He says, I know you're not drunk, but you don't have a license. I said, well, come on, man. It's mere technicalities. I'm going home. So anyway, with my record, that's kind of a big deal. So I got you know, a felony driving license suspended, which they wanted to send me to prison for, and that's about the time I got sober. I knew that if I didn't quit drinking, I was already going back because we had beat one driving license suspended before that, which was a misdemeanor. So this one, I beat the DUI pretty much. And so the state really had me dead to the wrong on this one. And they definitely wanted to send me back to prison. So, you know, I'm like, whoa, man, this is getting pretty serious. So I'm living on mom's couch. The house I owned with my ex and I were about ready to kill each other. So I'm sleeping on mom's couch and I'm supposed to be going to AA. Well, I went to two meetings in 2 weeks. And again, this is where my friend Dave, I remember I went and saw him in treatment and I stayed up all night and to support my buddy. And I went in there looking like the Looney Tunes. And, you know, he gets out and he's like, yeah, blah, 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 talking about recovery and everything. I'm like, yeah, that's cool, that's cool. I go, well, what I'm doing right now is I'm practicing this program. I get one beer and I drink it all night. And that's what I do, you know. And then it came two beers. And then I was drunk again. And so what ended up happening is this one night I got laid off from the mortgage company I worked for, which kind of tells you why the mortgage industry went the way it went, because people like me are working there, and my mom's like, you got to go. You know, I had gotten a fight at this bar her friend owned, and she was there, and then I broke in her house, stole her car after she locked me out, and said, you got to go. You got to go somewhere. You can't stay here, you know. And this guy, Dan, I had worked with, had given my mom his number, and somehow the topic of Alcoholics Anonymous came up. And he had been sober a year, and he gave his number to my mother and said, tell Michael to give me a call. That's what my mom calls me, Michael. And I'll take him to meetings. I go every night. And I thought, holy smokes, every night? And I'm like, wow, that's a lot of meetings. That'll take me about 2 months to do that because I only had to go to one a week. And then I figured out you sign with your left hand and whatnot. That morning, I hated Dan, which I hated a lot of people unless you had something I wanted or had a job I wanted or, you know, something of that nature where people liked you and I wanted to be close to you. But Dan had none of that. So I called him that morning. I was like, you know, I had no other options. I remember it was like prison, AA. Can you give me 10? Let me think about this. You know, I mean, I've got nothing going for me. I don't have any friends. I've got, you know, plaintiffs and I got co-defendants and, you know, stuff like that. I don't have friends. You know, there's no one to call. So I called Dan up and Dan says, you want to go to a meeting tonight? And I said, sure. Yeah, whatever. That was like 10 o'clock. I remember by 8 o'clock, though, when I went to that meeting, I had it all figured out. And, you know, Dan met me after the meeting and said he'd be my sponsor, which I had no clue what that meant. And he said he would pick me up the next night at 7:15. We're going to another meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. That was a Saturday night. That Sunday night he picked me up, and I have no clue why I agreed to go with Dan. And I went with Dan every day. And I think Dan finally got tired of me, like, because I was just going every day with him. And the more I went, the angrier I got, and the more I hated going because I had to go. I was court ordered to do 6 months in the county jail. That was part of my plea bargain on that for not going to prison. And I remember telling Dan, I was like, Dan, you know, AA's working great, man. I'm staying sober, but, you know, I'm going to go to jail for 6 months. I'm going to lose my house, this crappy-ass job I got, and all this stuff I got going for me right now, you know. And he'd be like, oh, yeah, I understand. Pray about it. I'm like, thinking, dude, first off, have you ever, I'm thinking, well, of course, I'd never say anything to him, but I was like, have you ever done a day in jail? I mean, like, seriously, 6 months? Come on. I'd be out in five, you know, and then what do I have? Nothing. And he, same thing. And I'd go, and for whatever reason, they never called me. And I remember I got my license back, and that's what the charge was. I went to my probation officer. I said, you know, I haven't gone to jail yet, and I've been waiting like 6 months, you know, and it's kind of stressful. She's like, well, you know, you're going to meetings, you've got a job, and blah, 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 which the job was working, doing air conditioning work, riding a three-speed bicycle, BMW, three-speed bicycle, money, broke, you know, because I had all these doctor bills, lawyer bills, probation, fines, restitution, to pay all this stuff on $7.50 an hour. Oh, and I'm paying the mortgage on this house, so there's not a lot to go around. And she goes, I don't see why you can't go in front of the judge again. So I go in front of the judge with my attorney, and my Dan's with me, and we go up there, and the judge says, go ahead and reverse the sentence, give him 150 community service hours. And I was like, what? You know, because for me, breaks had stopped a long time ago, you know, and even my attorney was like, you know, looked over at me. He walks out, he goes, I can't believe that judge did that. You know, and I'm like, you? He goes, you just had the biggest break, and you need to take that break and run with it. And that's what my attorney told me. And, you know, I never saw him again after that for like 2 years later. And my sponsor's like, yeah, your attorney's right. Now, you know, I paid this man a lot of money. He was not my buddy by no stretch of the imagination. But that resonated with me. And I saw him like 2 years later, and I was working at this restaurant, and he came in there, and he's eating. I went up to him. I said, hey, Jack. He says, you know how they do. How you doing? And I'm like, I'm doing great, man. You know, I've been sober. I think I was sober like 2 years at the time. And I said, I just want to thank you for what you told me that day in the courtroom. And he said, okay. Like, he didn't even have, couldn't even remember what he told me or anything. And he's like, well, take care. You know, and I'm like, all right, well, thank you, you know, because because I had paid all my debt to him. That's all probably he was concerned with, which now he's a circuit judge in Pinellas County. He's done really well for himself dealing with people like me. So I go about the business. I get a year. You know, I got involved in this young people's group, which there was only two in the state of Florida at this time. And, you know, that was a lot of fun, you know, getting involved in that young people's group and doing all the stuff we did. I mean, there was like eight people in the beginning. By the time before, it was up to 100 and something. And then this group started. And then all these other young people's groups started, you know, went to the International Convention of Alcoholics Anonymous in 2000 in Minneapolis, St. Paul. I had a little over a year. That was awesome. You know, I ended up, when I got a year, I got my sponsor, Lou, because Dan had fallen off, and ultimately Dan quit going to AA, and then Lou became my sponsor, and that was great. You know, Lou was like this old guy who drove a Cadillac and had nothing in common with me. You know, and people are like, why do you have him? Dude, I don't want what I have, okay? You know, I know how to be an idiot. You know what I mean? Lou drank till he was 51 years old. You know, I only drank for probably 7 years total, you know, maybe, you know what I mean? I'm like, how did this guy do it? You know, I want what he has, you know. He'd always tell me stuff like, you can catch more bees with honey than vinegar. I'm like, what? You know, I'm like, because I get so mad. Mad is an understatement. Rageful is more appropriate. And I hated everybody in AA. Except Lou and my other buddy. And I remember my one buddy says, you know, what happens if Lou dies and I get drunk? You're not going to have any friends in AA. And I'm like, well, that's okay. You know, I'm not here to make friends, okay? You know, and what it was, I was just, you know, I had no kind of social skills. I really did not know how to just be a friend to somebody. You know, it was like, what can you do for me? You know, it was never, what can I do for you? Absolutely not. You know, it was, what can you do for me? That was how I lived my life, unbeknownst to me. So, you know, I'm going with Lou. Lou gets me involved in service, you know, sponsoring guys, supporting the home group, you know, the whole deal. We go up to Boston. I had like 9 months in these young, they had this young people's group up there, and it was crazy. It was like the wildest thing I've ever seen, you know. And they're like, you got to go back to your town and make it happen like that. You know, and that girl and her husband, she ended up speaking at the 2000 International, and all those people from Boston were there. So that's what we did. We, you know, we just got started rallying around, going to treatment centers and getting young people to come to the group, you know, and it worked. And, you know, when I was a little after a year sober, coming up on 2 years, I about lost my mind, which, you know, is appropriate for somebody like me. And then I realized that Lou's like, you probably need to get some outside help. And I was like, you're probably right. And so I started on that journey. And then it was a little after 2 years I met who is now my wife. And I went to go get some parts at this parts store, and there she was. It was like, whoa. And, you know, I saw her, and then I came back soon, you know, just to get another glancing blow. And, you know, and I said, I just want to tell you, you're gorgeous, you know, and left, you know. And she called me, you know, and I was like, whoa. And so we started dating, and you know, she ended up finding the program that works for her. I'm doing AA. She's doing her thing. You know, we went to the Detroit Iggy Paw, and, you know, we were just on fire. I ended up proposing to her a year to the day of my 5-year, because they said you don't get your marbles back till you're 5 years sober. So we got married on my 5-year anniversary. Lou was my best man, and the guy I sponsored at the time was my other best man. And, you know, it was great. You know, it was really good. You know, I was doing all the service work. We get married, you know. Then I really had no careers, per se. You know, I did a lot of things, but really was not, had like, what would you say your trade would be, Mike? And I don't know. I do a lot of good things. What do you want me to do? You know, so my wife's always like, you know, you love doing this, blah, blah, blah. Why don't you do it? Oh, I can't do that. I can't do that. You know, and so she kept pushing me. So I got a job doing it and worked there for like 2 years and ended up opening my own business afterwards. You know, right after we got married, about 6 months later, opened my own business, did really successful with it. The problem with that is I was really successful with it, and it got to be the most important thing in my life. And, you know, some people can go to one meeting in a week. You know, I can go to a meeting a day, sponsor guys, go to treatment centers, and be crazy as hell. On the outside, it looked like, man, he's got it together. But I was losing it on the inside. And at 3 years of that business, I had to walk away from it. You know, I was very first lose my recovery, lose my wife, and then ultimately I would have lost the business anyway. I never forget, I was sitting there and contemplating maybe I should load everything up that I have as much as I can and go back to New Orleans. And my sponsor calls me. He says, "What are you thinking about, Mike?" And I said, "Well, to be honest, I'm thinking about leaving everything." And he's like, "Really? Why is that?" And I said, "I'm just tired of it all." And, it was like, bring, and I was, and that turned a page. I ended up walking away from that, getting more involved. And Joni Evans, like, that was the one thing I was so blessed with, the men and women that were around me in Alcoholics, like Chuck Schultz, Joni Evans, all these people that I passed, were instrumental in me staying sober. I remember Chuck and Tommy gave me this car one time because I had wrecked my motorcycle, not once but twice, but the last time I fractured my ankle in three spots, and I needed a vehicle because I had to sell everything I owned because, of course, I don't have insurance, and I was waiting tables and stuff. And I remember Chuck and them were like, "Hey, we got a car for you." And I'm like, "Awesome, man. That's just what I need, And we go to pick it up, and I'm like looking through the trailer park. I'm like, because that's where all the old people in St. Pete live. And because, they're doing AA service work. And we pull up to this car, and I'm like, "Wow, that son of a bitch even run?" we didn't even get a block away. It overheated. And I'm like, "Oh, man." But I fixed that car up, and I loaded it up with newcomers. I remember one night I went to Mustard Seed. I had three in the back, two in the front, and I'll never forget. I don't know why I said it, but we were having so much fun going to my sponsor's group way out in Seminole. And I said, "You know what? We're having a good time, but the reality is most of us aren't going to stay sober." And out of that car, only one person stayed sober. That was me. And that's the reality of AA. And, I stuck with that, and the last few years have been, I don't know, life has showed up like hell. I tried to, my wife always asked me about my dad and my brother, and I never pursued that any. And then about 4 years ago, I started looking for my brother, and I had tried to find him when I first got sober and couldn't. And then I started looking on the internet, and I found some numbers, and I called this number. And I knew he had gotten married and had kids and stuff, and lady answers the phone. I said, "I'm Michael Heath, and I'm looking for my brother." And she's like, first thing she says is, "Oh," I'm like, "Oh man, this isn't good." And she says, "Oh man, I hate to tell you like this, but there's no other way to tell you. Your brother died back in 2001. And I'm like, and I was shook to my core because my brother was a good guy. He went to college. He always tried to help me out, did the right thing. He's actually one of the coaches on LSU football team when DiNardo was a coach, which they were very successful, and always did the right thing. He was just a good stand-up guy. And, Meg's telling me all this stuff. And I remember I was floored. I was in shock, and I told her, I've been sober in AA at that time, like 9 years. She goes, "That's great." She goes, "My parents have been sober for over 20 years in Alcoholics Anonymous. And my brother, I got addicted to prescription pills, and they had tried to help my brother like hell. And he was very violent, very angry, and he wasn't a heavy drinker or anything, but he got hooked. He was a pharmacy rep, he had free reign to these pills back in the 90s. It was totally different than it is today, and got hooked on them. And he would only do outpatient. He'd never do inpatient. And ultimately, that led to his death. And so, through that, I'll never forget, I was so distraught. And the guy I was sponsoring at the time calls me up. He's like, "Hey, man, can we do my fourth step tonight?" I'm like, "Yeah, sure. Why not?" So I go to the meeting, and he's like, "What's wrong?" And I tell him, we do his four step because AA is always there when I need it most. And so that was a pretty big deal like 3-4 years ago. Then my wife gets in his graduate program up in New Jersey. I open another business, close the business. Now I see her once a month. I go up to New Jersey once a month. And then what happened is my sponsor got sick. And, he's older, real, And he went in for the surgery, and I've been around long enough. I've been with these guys, man. They go in for surgery. It's never good. And I'm trying to be optimistic about it. I go in there, and, he has a procedure. And that night we go in there after a procedure, and he doesn't feel good at all, And I'm like, "Lou, come on, man. We got to get you up moving around and stuff." And we get him up, and he collapses and, stop breathing and everything right there. I'm holding him on the ground. And, and it kind of goes crazy in the hospital at that time. It's like everything goes haywire, and they come in there, and basically he died 7 days later. And that was tough. That was real tough. My wife was in New Jersey. I'm down here, trying to deal with this and along with life, And I just remember, you know, spending that time with him, because I knew he was, you know, last thing we went to was Kip. We went to see Kip C, and he's up there talking about he's got, you know, his cancer, and he ultimately, that was the last time he ever spoke too. He died after that, but that was the last meeting he went to, my sponsor, and you know, it was good. It was good that I was there, but it was bad that I was there, because I got to see him basically, you know, he left that day, you know, and after that he was on life support, and he was never really there per se. But now on the flip side, you know, everything is now changed again. You know, my wife's going to move back down here. We're going to stay in Florida because I was moving to New Jersey, which I don't think she's from New Jersey because she doesn't have an accent. You know, I beg to differ. You know, everybody from Jersey's got an accent. So we're going to stay in Florida, and I'm going to continue doing what I'm doing, and I think I'm going to end on that. Is it time? 1 minute? It's time? All right. I got one real long story I'll tell you. There's a guy, and he's out walking around on this mountain, and he comes up on this farm, and he sees all these chickens on this farm, and he sees a bald eagle with the chickens acting like a chicken, you know, and he's like, that is the craziest thing I've ever seen. So he goes up to the farmer and says, hey, farmer, you know that's a bald eagle you got there with all your chickens? He goes, yeah, I do know it is. And I go, he's the sorriest chicken I ever had. And the guy's like, well, he's a bald eagle. He's not supposed to be a chicken. And he says, I know. He says, and the farmer says, you want him? You can have him, you know, because he's useless to me, and the rooster hates him. And so the guy takes the bald eagle. He goes up to the mountaintop, and he says, you know, you're an eagle. You need to soar and fly. And he throws him up in the air. Boom, comes right back down. Starts acting like a chicken. He's like, no, you got to do this. You got to do this. Throws him up again. He starts to fly a little bit. Comes right back down. Does it again. Finally starts soaring, you know. And that's what AA's done for me. Thank you.